Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
You are listening to Interchange here on WFHB. I'm Allison Bektesh, your host. Today we have Chris Weisler and Megan Anderson from Coal Free IU. Chris is the research coordinator for that organization and Megan is the president. Welcome both.
Thanks. Thank you.
We're going to talk about your organization and what you're doing to combat coal use at IU. Let's jump right into it. Well, let me first say that Coal Free IU is sponsored by the Sierra Student Coalition and Sierra Club. The intent is to shut down or replace campus-based coal plants and end dependence on coal-generated electricity. So I do want to hear about how your organization does that, but I just want to get right to the problem of coal. If you can begin by getting into the health and environmental risks that using coal provides.
Okay. So coal is the source of energy for most of Indiana, and it's nearly all the energy for an Indian university. And it's really dangerous at all steps of its usage. The mining and the treatment of coal releases a lot of chemicals, at least 19 carcinogens. And that includes things like mercury and lead and things like that. And just washing it and that kind of thing puts waste that we call slurry ponds into Indiana, and that's also where the waste from burning coal goes to. And these ponds are all over the state. We have more ponds in Indiana than any other state. And they have all these concentrated chemicals that cause a whole bunch of problems for Indiana.
I want to split it up into the difference between health risks and environmental risks. Mm-hmm. So if you could begin with health, what does it matter that those chemicals are out there?
Okay, yeah, thanks. A lot of the chemicals that come out of coal burning, things like sulfur dioxide and nitrous gases, they produce smog and acid rain, which I guess we all know are bad for trees and for respiration in humans and in other animals as well. There's also mercury in there, which causes some neural problems and some development problems. There's things like carbon dioxide, of course, which is a huge contributor to global climate change. Coal is actually, in fact, the biggest contributor to global climate change. Mm-hmm.
So other health-related risks are any sort of lung and respiratory issues that you have will be exacerbated, and it can cause lung cancer. And another risk is cardiovascular disease, which this is Heart Awareness Month. So, you know, it's important to note that coal plant pollution is a large source for exacerbating those kind of issues. So
we're talking about everyone is affected by this, or this is the miners who are down gathering the coal are exposed to this, mm-hmm. or this is from coal plants who burn coal that affects people.
Right. So every step of the process affects people. So in the mining process, it affects miners directly. People still get black lung. That's not a myth. People get black lung during surface mining. And then communities that are living in areas that are surrounded, or the coal mining communities, people that aren't actually in the mine, people that live near it, are exposed to ash and dust from the mine. And that also gives them lung problems. It causes cancer, and their water sources are polluted. And that's especially an issue when we're talking about Appalachia region. And they just came out with some studies that have shown that people are more susceptible to cancer and that their life expectancy is lower in those areas. And that also goes with their economic standing and their living conditions are lower. So that's the mining process. And then when you get to the burning process, really everyone's affected. It affects a really wide radius. They have pinned it between 70 and 90 miles from the coal plant. And, you know, often Indiana has been sued by other states because of acid rain, you know, that we're causing in the East Coast, and smog and those kind of things. So, you know, it's affecting everyone throughout the whole process, and that's really important to note.
Some of your literature talks about social justice along mm-hmm. with these health and environmental effects, and I didn't quite understand that, but I think you may have just touched on that a bit, mentioning that these communities around these coal plants are more disadvantaged communities. Mm-hmm. Is there any relation between that?
Yes. So you can look up environmental justice scores for all states. Indiana's has a low environmental justice score, and you'll find that coal plants are typically located in lower socioeconomic areas because most people don't want to big coal plant that's producing tons of, you know, toxic materials right by their home. And some communities don't have the ability to fight for that kind of justice. So, and then the other piece, you know, is that mining communities have trouble, especially mountaintop removal communities where blasting's happening. Other businesses and industries can't really thrive in that environment. So you'll find that, you know, there's a lot of flight from businesses, from people that need to move. And that is just creating all kinds of problems economically too. So,
well, with mountaintop removal, let's talk about the environmental mm-hmm. aspect then of mining coal and using it for energy. Where do we get that coal, and how, what else is it affecting while we do that?
Well, all the coal that is used for Indiana University's coal plant, it actually has to come from Indiana, which is home to a lot of coal mining. It actually is home to the largest coal mine in the eastern United States, this Bear Run mine operated by Peabody Coal. But outside of Indiana, there's a lot of coal mountaintop removal, like you're saying, and that does cause some problems with especially the local streams that get buried over. There's a lot of biodiversity in there that's lost because of that.
Mm-hmm. Peabody was actually ranked dead last out of the Fortune 500 companies on their greenness scale by Newsweek. So what are the tactics that Peabody is using, and why the low ranking?
Well, you know, if you're a company that is contributing to mountaintop removal and to strip mining in large areas, you're going to have trouble, you know, keeping contaminants contained. You know, and there are several processes that they do to try and keep dust down in mines and on top of strip mines, but there's only so much you can do, and a lot of companies fall below the standard regulations. And that's something that has been under scrutiny, especially since we saw the mining accidents that happened in the past couple of years. So that would probably be part of the ranking issues. And then, you know, where do they dump their coal ash? Because they also usually are trucking back coal ash. And, you know, if it's a state like Indiana that there are no regulations on the coal ash retention ponds, you know, it's really a question mark as to, like, how safe those are. And Tennessee, a couple of years ago, there was a huge, huge slurry pond that burst and wiped out an entire town. And accidents like that are known to happen, and you know, when we're talking, no one's checking on the coal ash retention ponds we have in our state. That's a big problem.
So I picture, you know, like the canary in the coal mine, like men mm-hmm. down there working away. Is that, are they really going underground, and is there a potential for trap miners in the state of Indiana?
There are not as many underground mines in India. I think there might be one that's still semi-operational, but I think it's due to close, and I could be wrong, so I would say check that. But mainly we do strip mining, which is surface mining, right? But the problem is that it does end up getting deeper and deeper. So it's not the traditional coal mining you picture, but that does happen in other states still. And then, you know, so we bypassed it with strip mining, but mountaintop removal is also another way that was bypassed in states like West Virginia, where traditional coal mining underground did supply, you know, hundreds and hundreds of jobs for the state. Mountaintop removal and strip mining with huge drag lines eliminates jobs. And we're finding that, you know, the more mechanization that they have, the less jobs it provides for people. So
strip mining is just kind of skimming off the surface process,
right?
And very mechanical.
Exactly.
Right. It's like the coring you see around Indiana.
Okay, and then back to these slurry ponds, you're saying that, you know, Indiana's really lax on its regulations. Are there groups that have tried to make their way, or has the legislation tried to kind of reel this in, or is mm-hmm. Indiana just no one's making the move right now in Indiana?
I think that one of the problems has been that until recently, a lot of those coal ash ponds weren't identified. The EPA just recently did rankings and surveys of all the states to find coal ash ponds, and they were having a lot of difficulty in Indiana. So I think that, you know, if people aren't keeping track of it, maybe people aren't aware of it. And they're concentrated too in southern Indiana, which is where a lot of the mining happens and where a lot of the coal plants are located. So, you know, it kind of goes along that whole process.
We'll talk throughout the show about other ways to get energy, but I am curious how coal compares to other energy sources as far as the damage on environment. I don't think it's the only way that we are able to damage our environment, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Where does it rank?
Mm-hmm. Coal is one of the worst ones, actually. It puts more pollutants, more direct pollutants into the atmosphere than really any other source that we have available. And it's also more destructive on its way out of the ground as well than anything else we could use.
Is that it's a destructive to just the land there, or are there populations of animals that we're also seeing? Mm-hmm.
Well, most of the problems are things like the chemicals that come into coal slurry, as well as acid mine drainage problems that we have with coal mining. So most of the problems are going to be chemical based, mm-hmm. and that certainly can harm wildlife populations.
And so we saw too, in Appalachia, which is the most biologically diverse region that we have in our country, you know, that was a total loss of biodiversity. Over 500 mountains have been blasted in that area, and you can't get that back, you know, because that's thousands and thousands of years of diversity that's building up. And then with Bear Run, I know that there was some talk of an endangered owl species that had lived there, and I'm sure there was tons of other groups of animal populations that live there. So, you know, they've got to migrate out, and you wonder what happens to those populations. So,
now I'm hoping you can inform me a little bit too about how coal becomes electricity. So we know we have a substance that has all these harmful chemicals, and in the process of using it for our own good, we also get more chemicals out into the atmosphere. But are you able to speak at all about the science behind using coal as electricity?
Well, coal is based of very, very old decomposed trees. Have a lot of carbon stored up in a very small amount of rock. And we can burn the coal, and that releases the carbon as heat, and that carbon then goes in the atmosphere. But the heat turns turbines, that creates electricity that way.
Mm-hmm. And then at our central heating plant on campus, we use steam power, so it's heating thousands of gallons of water, and then that steam is what is heating and cooling the buildings and the water on campus.
Well, that's a great lead-in, because my next question is how does Indiana University use coal? I mean, where do they get it? Where is it stored? And then where is it going?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, all of Indiana University's coal has to come from Indiana.
That's a school
that's
mandate
a state
or state mandate?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we get our coal from the heating plant from Peabody Coal, which we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. And is that train?
It comes by truck. Which is actually an issue. I know the winter before, it was so icy that the truck couldn't get through, and we have a very small supply of oil that we can burn, only a few hours. So it's a huge problem in reserve, just in case of an emergency, correct? And so, you know, when a truck can't get there, that could mean no heating and cooling for campus in freezing conditions, which is a problem. So, you know, that system isn't the most reliable system, and a lot of people talk about how reliable coal is, but so that's an issue. And there is a train, though, that comes through campus, but it doesn't deliver our coal, but it is transferring coal to other areas.
Interesting.
So, and the train tracks run right behind the coal plant. So
I would imagine that Indiana uses a lot of coal.
Yes. We use 68,000 tons annually, about.
How often and how many truckloads are showing up on campus every day to provide that then?
Right. There are truckloads that come through every day. Okay. It depends on the season. And yeah, they come as often as they need to, but every single day.
Mm-hmm. And they bring it directly to the coal plant on 10th and Fee Lane on campus?
That's right. And so there is a little station right beside the coal plant that they dump that into, and it's washed there. And I know that there's a building behind the coal plant where some of that processed material goes. Do you know what I'm talking about? That structure that we toured.
Have you been to the facility?
Yeah, and actually, anybody can tour it. So it's a really great experience to go through with any student groups on campus, or if you're a community group, it's a good process. So,
what's coming in gets used almost immediately. There's not like a too much of a storage or
right. There was storage in the past, and they got rid of it, I think. So,
and once they have it, how reliant is IU on that day-to-day functionality? How much do they rely on that coal that they're burning?
All of the heat on the campus comes from coal, so all of it does. And the rest of the energy that we use for other things besides heat all comes from Duke Energy, which is almost completely coal again. Mm-hmm. So there's a very, very tiny fraction of the energy that comes from Duke that's not coal. Mm-hmm. But basically when you talk about energy at any university, it's all coal.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so IU purchases as much renewable energy credits as they can, but there's not and nearly enough to actually offset the amount of coal or amount of electricity that they're using. So,
and you say all of the heat, that means any building that the university owns or maintains is run by?
Well, actually, the IU Office of Sustainability just moved to a new location, and they are now powered by a geothermal loop that's located in a really tiny space behind their building. So that's exciting. And I think that IU has now experimented a little bit with solar water heating. So I guess, you know, that portion is not coming from coal now, part of it. There's 45 kilowatts total of solar energy on campus. Coal-Free IU put up the first solar panels on campus. We installed 2 kilowatts from the IU Senior Fund grant that we won in 2010. That was installed. And so that's really exciting. That's on top of the IMU. And then after that, IU started installing solar panels on some other buildings around campus. So that was exciting.
So I would think for the history of IU, they've had to use more coal because there's more students, but perhaps there is also this trend that they're trying to back away from coal. Do you have any view of kind of the history of IU's reliance on coal?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as we can tell, IU plans to stay on coal for the foreseeable future. If we change it all, it seems like we're going to go to natural gas because our boilers are also able to support natural gas, which is certainly harmful to the environment, but not quite so much as coal. We've also invested in clean coal technologies, which are less good than they seem. I guess maybe we'll talk about that later.
Right. That's a complex discussion, but IU made a $2 million research investment in the past couple of years with a partnership with China, which is kind of interesting. So, and that was in clean coal technology, but clean coal is kind of a misnomer and is kind of representing a broad spectrum of technologies that are used to capture and sequester coal contaminants and to, I guess, use technologies to burn coal slightly differently.
Wonderful. Well, I want to definitely get into that conversation of what some alternatives to coal are later in the show. I also want to find out more about Coal-Free IU. You're a new group making some big steps, and so we'll be talking about that as we come out of the break. Again, you're listening to Interchange on WFHB. I'm Allison Bechtish, and I'm here with Chris Wiesler and Megan Anderson of Coal-Free IU. We'll be right back. Back listening to Interchange. I'm your host, Allison Bechtesh, and I am here with Chris Wiesler and Megan Anderson from Coal-Free IU. Chris is the research coordinator. Megan is the president, both students at IU as well. So we've talked about some of the hazards of coal and reasons to get away from reliance on coal. We know that it's a problem. IU is run by coal, which has negative health and environmental effects. So 2.5 years ago, students got together and decided to work towards eliminating that reliance. Can you give me a little bit of history on the coal-free IU organization?
Yes. Yeah. So we launched in 2009, and we're part of the Sierra Student Coalition and the Sierra Club, which is one of the largest and oldest grassroots organizations in the country. And we are focused on transitioning IU beyond coal to 100% renewable energy in the future, hopefully. So we first began by really figuring out, you know, what does it mean to have a coal plant on your campus and what does that process look like and what were our alternatives. And it's really great. We've had a really amazing couple of years. A lot of things have happened and we've had a really diverse set of activities that we do. So I can just talk a little bit about those. So some of the things that we focus on is research and education, and we always want all of our events to have a component of education to them because this is a, you know, a pretty big subject. So we have really creative ways of making that happen, and then we have some more traditional things. So we've held creative grassroots events like art installations. We've had a giant coal train on campus before, and we'll have fact sheets available for people to read, and we'll be on the ground talking to people and petitioning. And we have petitions that say that, you know, as students, alumni, community members, faculty, we want to see IU transition beyond coal, and people are able to sign those and learn about coal. And that's a really, like, interactive and fun way to make a big impact and be visible. This year, we had a giant inhaler to talk about, you know, asthma and respiratory health and how coal impacts that. And then other kinds of events that we have are really centered on education. We've had panels with different faculty and community members speak on them. We have speakers come in from different areas. We've had Larry Gibson, who lives on Kayford Mountain in West Virginia, come and talk about mountaintop removal. And then other things we do are host films, so people can come and watch a documentary and kind of get a new perspective on the subject. We'll have a discussion after that. And then we also hold weekly meetings, which is open to everyone. And those are at 7:15 p.m. in Ballantyne Hall, room 016. And we encourage everybody to come. And we do different things during meetings. Sometimes, you know, if there's a lot of newer members, we'll focus on, you know, kind of explaining the process of coal. And then we're always planning the next event. It seems like we have a really active group. Yeah, so we're doing something, you know, every other week. I can talk about the event we had today, which was centered on Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. We made about 200 handmade Valentines over the weekend, and those had different messages on them, like, you don't have to burn coal to warm my heart, or have a heart for clean energy. And then we spent all day yesterday sitting on campus and talking to people about coal and having them sign these handmade Valentine's Day petitions. And we also took photos with people holding giant Valentines, which were big hearts that said, you know, I love clean energy, or coal breaks my heart, things like that. And we sent in those petitions today to President McRobbie at his office. And that was part of carrying on our big petition delivery, which we had last month. Sierra Club sponsored an IU game, which was a pretty creative and innovative way for a nonprofit to get their message out. And so that was exciting for us to be a part of. And then after that, the next day we went ahead. Oh, and I should mention the rally towels. Those were pretty cool. We passed those out to students and, you know, they said, score one for clean air and, you know, go Hoosiers. And that was great. And a lot of people were excited and happy to see, like, a positive message at the game. And then the next day we delivered 5,000 petitions that we've been collecting over the course of the last couple of years to President McRobbie's office. So that was also really great.
Well, I'm very curious about the administration's response, but I'm also, when you have these big objects on campus and you're trying to stop a student as they're going to class, what is your response? Do people take the time to stop and find out about what you're talking about? Do they show concern? Or, I mean, everybody's warm in the winter and that is helpful too. So, you know, what is that response?
Yeah, and I think it's been really great. We get a really positive response. I think people are coming to the place now where they understand that we really need to diversify our energy resources and that we have options that are, you know, more socioeconomically just than the ones that we're using in the past. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of concern about having, living near a coal plant, studying near a coal plant. You know, in the 70s, people told me that it used to strip the paint off their car and that they'd wake up tasting sulfur in their mouth. Luckily, the coal plants made a lot of improvements.
Here on campus.
Yes, here on campus in Bloomington. And, you know, the coal plants come a long way in making improvements to help with air pollution. And we appreciate that as a group. And, you know, but we also know that the campus is expanding. And we have to think about, you know, what makes up our energy portfolio and what are our options and how can we be innovative? How can we be leaders? A lot of people in our generation really believe in, you know, a clean energy future. And we see that that's a growing sector even during the recession. And that's where our jobs can be. And that's what can make us, you know, thrive better on this tiny planet together. So that's exciting. It's, yeah.
So you talk about, you know, the many people who want to make a difference, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean you're always able to. So if you have a little more of that background, how do you go from a couple people meeting in a room saying we should change this to a campus-wide organization that's tied into a national organization?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, the biggest thing is we're always looking to educate people because we really believe that people, it all has to do with conservation too. You know, people need to make better decisions about how they use your energy. And we spend a lot of time connecting with other student groups who are focused on similar goals. And you know, there's a lot of unlikely connections that we make too, you know, social justice issues, which people don't always think of their environment, but that is part of the reason why people are sometimes stuck in the situations they're in. So other things we do though are like applying for grants for solar panels. You know, that is a way for us to work with, you know, different boards at IU that are making decisions to connect with seniors and help them, like, fulfill a mission that, and a legacy they can leave on campus, you know. So there's a lot of great ways that we're building connections and making changes every day, so.
And how is the organization run? Do you have a adult mentor, you know, or is it all the students getting together? Are there officers? How do you make your decisions?
Yeah, so the organization was started by the Sierra Student Coalition. There was an organizer that was sponsored by them, but largely what an organizer does is they equip people and teach people how to run their own campaigns so that, you know, these campaigns can be sustainable over a long amount of time. Nobody thinks the coal plant's going to get shut down tomorrow, and we don't necessarily want that to happen. That wouldn't be very practical. You know, we need a new source of energy. So a lot of what we do is continue that on by helping train different people in our campaign on how to function as a group and how to run a successful campaign. And that means that we engage with media, like an interview right now, which is great. Thank you. Yeah. You know, or we teach people how to petition. We teach them how to do a lot of things. And that partially we'll attend conferences, environmental conferences, to connect with other youth. And we share and trade practices, what works, what doesn't. And we learn more about the topic that we're studying. So that's exciting. And it takes a real diversity of skills. You know, we need people that are interested in art, you know, to do large art installations or do graphic design, you know, things for us so we can send electronic Valentines like we did today. So that's really exciting.
How many students do you currently have involved with the organization?
Over the course of this year, we've interacted with probably like 300 new people altogether. We have about 40 regular volunteers that come in and out. And it's great because our group has a lot of flexibility. So, you know, somebody may not be able to attend every week, but they come to our events, you know, and they come and petition when they have time. And so that's really good.
And do you actively recruit? How do you try and get people to join and give their time?
Mm-hmm. I think that it's really great at events. Usually that's our recruiting method. You know, we don't normally have to run recruitment drives like we might have when we first started. And that's a good sign. You know, that means people are interested in this topic. They want to create a change. And so, you know, we get volunteers plugged in a lot of different ways. Some of those are through events. Some is just, we do some like posters, and we always make them have an educational component. So, you know, we had some earlier in the semester that had coal facts on them, but they were in the form of a nutritional fact sheet. And, you know, things like that catch people's eyes. They teach them something new, and they let them know how to get in contact with us.
And then how is this tied in with the National Sierra Student Coalition and the Sierra Club? How much interaction do you have with them, and what kind of support are they giving you?
Mm-hmm. So we actually you know, we really do our own thing on the local level. We know best, obviously, what's going to work well in our community and create the change we want to see. We have really gotten closer, though, with other branches of the same campaign that we're in this year, and really worked on finding similarities between our campaigns. But, you know, everything, you know, we know what's best, obviously, for, like, our campus. And so we run most of it ourselves. But, you know, Sierra Club and Sierra Student Coalition, you know, the better we can connect as an environmental movement with people that are working on this issue all across the country, the better it'll be for everyone, because we all want to see a clean energy future. So that's something that we're focusing on this year.
Excellent. And do you do fundraising at all? And where would those funds go? What projects are you putting those towards?
Mm-hmm. We don't need a ton of money normally. So the only things that we usually fundraise are for things like if we wanted a speaker, we'll do fundraising for that. Or if we do a training conference and we have to travel, we'll do fundraising for those kind of activities. And we find that, you know, we have a lot of really great allies in the community that are willing to support students who want to learn about the environment and learn how to make positive changes. And that's been really great. And that's also a good way for us to connect with different people that are working on the same issue. We've had community groups sponsor us too, and that's been really great. So.
Okay, well, I am very curious. You had your big event today, this Valentine petition, and that's on top of last month's event, 5,000. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've had your tour of the facility, so maybe a little bit of interaction with some of the administrators. But mm-hmm. I'm very curious as to the Indiana University's official response to you, if you've received one.
Mm-hmm. So we are currently waiting on an official response. Due in part to some unforeseen events, which is fine. But, you know, I think that it's been really great. We've had a great relationship with Bill Brown, who's the director of sustainability at IU, and Tom Morrison, who's in charge of facilities. And Tom Morrison also led the geothermal project at Ball State, which is an incredible project where they, you know, they had the choice to update their boilers, but they got a better value by using geothermal to replace their coal plant on campus. So that's really exciting. So that has helped, and we've had that great relationship going. We're waiting on a response right now, but you know, it doesn't mean that it's not important to remind administrators that this is what students want to see for our future. So
over the course of a couple years that you've been an organization, you haven't had any direct contact with President McRobbie?
We had sent him an email once, and he forwarded it to Tom Morrison, which is fine. But, yeah, so we're waiting still to have a meeting with him. And that's, you know, really the president sets the vision for the campus, and we hope that that's a clean energy future. Right now, their goals and their sustainability reports and the campus master plan are for 30% reduction in CO2 by 2020. But we hope that that goal becomes more ambitious, because those kinds of reductions are being made in campuses across the country. So,
and once a university lays down a goal, what is there to ensure that they work towards that goal?
Right. So until we really have a commitment to move beyond coal and have some serious benchmarks, it's going to be difficult for us to measure and get there. And that's part of why it's so important that our group is able to connect with President McRobbie and, you know, discuss what we're hearing from these different people in our community and what our future looks like. So
do you have any success stories that you look to? Are there other campus groups nationwide that have convinced the administration to wean themselves off of this energy source?
Mm-hmm. There are 19 campuses that have been involved in the coal-free campaigns, the Beyond Coal campaign, sorry, that have committed to moving beyond coal. UNC was burning 100,000 tons of coal annually, and they're working on transitioning to biomass. There's a lot of campuses, obviously, that have switched. Like I said, Ball State is one in Indiana. Purdue just invested in a wind farm, which was interesting. It doesn't supply energy for their school, but they are selling the credits back. So, you know, there's a lot of different examples from those campuses.
Is there any theme that runs through them that finally they got this many students or finally they made this point? Like, is there a breaking point that you're trying to hit?
I think it's different for every campus, really. Our breaking point is waiting for administrators to, you know, set that vision for our school and get us there. And so that's pretty much where we're at.
Well, I'd imagine that when you propose that they get off coal, you also suggest something else, mm-hmm. because, like you said, we can't just shut down the plant immediately. So mm-hmm. I want to get into that in our next segment and find out some alternative ways of powering the university. But let's talk about some of the accomplishments that you have touched on so far, beginning to get little by little buildings powered in other ways or, mm-hmm. or water heated in other ways. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me the Center for Sustainability is not relying on coal at all anymore?
So the IU Office of Sustainability just moved into a renovated home. The renovations were partially, well, I think they might have been entirely sponsored by Duke Energy. And the goal is that building becomes net zero over the course of the next few years. And one of the ways that they accomplish that is through, you know, weatherizing the house and then adding the geothermal loop in the back of the building.
And that means that stuff escaping is going, what's it?
The idea is that there's a heat pump in the backyard of the building. And in Bloomington, the soil is constantly 53 degrees Fahrenheit. So in the winter, we can heat up a house, and in summer, we can cool it down. So they use a pipe to bring the heat up from the ground, is what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sorry that I cut you off. Other ways that they are becoming, zero, they would just rely on their own energy?
Right. So, you know, net zero is that they're producing as much as they're using. And that's really exciting. That's an ambitious goal and something that we hope to see on more campus buildings. Obviously, that's like a renovated home, so that's a little different. But one of the ways that our campus could get there is through, you know, efficiency projects to our buildings, which we probably need. We need to update our campus infrastructure because that'll save us money. So that's something that we could do.
Is that doable for, so this is a small home for an office. Is mm-hmm. that doable on the scale of one of the departments, one of
Definitely.
The bigger buildings?
Definitely, yeah.
But it takes the money?
It takes some investment, but there are some really creative ways that other campuses are making that happen. Some of those is through, you know, methods like a revolving loan fund, which would be, you know, some alumni money goes into an efficiency project, and then the money saved goes back into the fund, you know, and you will see savings with efficiency projects a lot quicker than you would with huge projects. So that's really exciting opportunity for our school.
All right. Well, we'll come back after the break and talk about some other brainstorms of options beyond coal. My name is Allison. I'm the host tonight for Interchange on WFHB. I'm here with Chris Weisler and Megan Anderson, the research coordinator and president of Coal Free IU, talking about Indiana University's reliance on coal. We will be back in just a moment.
WFHB's 20th annual Mardi Gras benefit is coming Tuesday, February 21st, to the Players Pub. This year's celebration includes the return of the Wild Raccoons plus six other local bands for a fat night of music, merriment, and masquerade. Advance tickets are available at Landlocked Music and the Players Pub. Brought to you by Vance Music, Players Pub, Karen Pitkin, Ellis Floral, Blooming Foods, Root Doctor, Zuzu Kalinda, the Wild Raccoons, and the Monkeyheads Social Aid and Pleasure Club. That's WFHB's 20th annual Mardi Gras benefit, all night long, Tuesday, February 21st, at the Players Pub.
on Interchange at WFHB. Joining me tonight is Chris Whistler and Megan Anderson from Coal Free IU, which is part of a national campaign sponsored by the Sierra Student Coalition and the Sierra Club. We've been talking about some of the effects on health and the environment that coal has, and more about the Coal Free IU organization. And you know, your main goal is to get us off coal, but we have to have a backup plan. So can you tell me a little bit about the alternative energy sources that you've researched, and if you've concluded on a single one that would be best for IU to transfer to?
Well, we, like Megan said earlier, we already have installed a small solar power, solar array on the roof of the union, actually. It's 2 kilowatts. Kilowatts, yeah, which is rather small, but it is a good start. Solar arrays, unfortunately, have a rather long payback period, so we're actually looking at some other sources, namely wind power and geothermal power are two of the leading ones right now. The problem with those, both of those, is that they are land intensive. They need a lot of layer area, and wind especially is not very great for Bloomington because we're kind of in a valley. We don't have the wind speeds we need to have a very great wind farm here.
Mm-hmm. So I think the one thing that we should make clear, though, is that we're more concerned about the central heating plant and how we transition, you know, our heating and cooling off of coal. Electricity is, you know, a totally different ballgame and something that we hope for in the future, but not something that we can have as much of, you know, a say in, especially because we're such a huge consumer and we need a lot of electricity to run the campus efficiently. So one of the things that, you know, we are looking at, like, how do we reduce our total coal use, and that could be accomplished by things like solar and wind. But we're talking about heating and cooling on campus. That takes a different kind of approach, and that needs to be accomplished through efficiency projects to reduce the amount of coal that we need to heat and cool the buildings. And then the other piece is looking at what are the different options for IU to use to heat and cool the buildings. One of those is geothermal, which can be done building by building. That, you know, then you get into like a cost discussion, right? You know, what's more effective cost-wise? Is it better to have a huge space where you can put a huge geothermal area, or, you know, to do it building by building? And I think that overall, like, what we've seen is that, you know, first of all, our group, you know, we don't have control over the prices of natural gas and coal, but we know that IU's retrofitted to burn natural gas, and if it became more cost effective, that would be something that they do. Natural gas doesn't put as many pollutants in the air as coal. When you burn coal, a lot less pollutants, in fact, close to none. So that's a better option. You know, we're talking about something like trying to work on how we reduce our impacts on climate change.
How is natural gas obtained?
Through hydrofracturing, which is not a good process. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about can that even be done safely? And, you know, the views of a lot of people in our group is, you know, the answer is probably no. Fracturing that deep into the ground causes a lot of disturbances, and using chemicals in that process, all throughout that process, is, you know, can have a lot of unforeseen consequences and a lot of predictable consequences, and none of them are really that good. So, you know, that's not an ideal solution that our group would like, you know, to advocate for. But we understand that the administrators have told us directly that what they choose is what's most cost effective for campus.
Bottom line.
Right. That's what, you know, the primary concern is for the institution right now. You know, our group, though, holds the view that costs are in a lot of forms, you know, including healthcare costs for people, you know, things that maybe aren't always factored into the equation. And I think that that is something that our nation is starting to understand more and more and will understand in the future, is that the cost is a lot more than what you see on paper. And it can be factored on paper now. You know, we can associate somewhat, you know, are people in this area, do they have more, you know, rates of higher rates of asthma, that kind of thing. So, yeah, but back to solutions, sorry. So, you know, our group would like to look at geothermal. I know that they've experimented with what kinds of biomass they have available to burn and, you know, how efficient those are at the, on campus. When we had our coal plant tour we were exposed to that. You know, biomass is a tricky thing too, right? You're like talking about what goes into biomass. Is it a forest, or, you know, is it like secondary processed paper, you know, that kind of thing. I know there's Alaskan paper pellets, which I don't know what the burn ratio is on those and that kind of thing, but those are better for the environment and aren't, you know, tearing down huge forests, you know. So there's always trade-offs with energy, but we know that there's better options for our campus and that they can make a lot of improvements with efficiency projects, with conservation, and, you know, that will really reduce our need for coal. Even our steam pipe infrastructure has outlived its lifespan, so that leaks a lot of steam out, which means that we're burning a lot more coal than we need to be and probably spending more money than we need to be, because an investment in replacing that would pay back within a couple of years. So
back to cost, since it's been told to you that that is what the factor is going to be in the end. And Chris, you mentioned the solar panels are up and running on the Union. However, I think your point there was that they were expensive. But putting up those upfront costs, eventually the sun is free, right? And so eventually that cost perhaps at least becomes equal to the cost of coal, and then eventually it becomes even cheaper. How can we calculate that, or how can they determine where do they draw the line on that cost?
Well, basically they compare the cost of buying coal continually versus the one-time price of a solar panel or a wind turbine or something. And usually what we're looking at for geothermal systems and wind projects is that the payback period is usually less than 30 years and can be as low as just a few years, maybe 5 years. So for a lot of the projects, it's very, very efficient. Just go ahead and buy the project, even though it's more expensive right now, because it's going to save a lot of money down the road.
And for solar panels as well?
Yes, although those to me a little bit longer than other renewable sources.
Yeah, but it's important to note too, though, that the price of solar panels is going down. I know that initially there was a lot of concern because China could undercut the price for various reasons, but American solar panels are becoming more price comparable, and so that's good news. And, you know, we'll see that the price of renewable energy is going down over time. So
you bring up China, which reminds me of a agreement that you alluded to between IU and China. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So we don't know a ton of details on that. We'd like to know more, and we kind of tried to investigate but didn't really find out a lot. But we know that IU invested money in a clean coal research partnership with a university in China. And clean coal technology is really incredibly expensive, and, you know, is another reason that should probably put up a red flag for people that maybe coal technology, there's better options than burning coal, when it costs, you know, an astronomical amount to try and capture the carbon that we're emitting and the other pollutants, and that there's no guarantee that they still aren't going to leak out of that area. You know, that's not something that is probably that great for our future.
Well, if IU right now is really only fitted for either coal or maybe natural gas, and they've invested in this, then it seems like perhaps that is one of their the next steps, is that they are going to go ahead and use clean coal, which sounds great. You know, if coal's dirty, then the clean kind would be better, right? Can you explain that a little more?
The idea of clean coal is that it would install scrubbers on top of the smokestacks, which really are just tanks where they can capture CO2 as it's escaping from the smokestack. And the problem with that is it won't capture all of the CO2, and it won't really even screen for any other pollutants in the coal waste. And then once it's even captured, it doesn't just go away. It actually gets buried, and it's actually very possible for that to leak into groundwater and become a pollutant once again, even after it's been removed from the equation.
So clean coal is obtaining coal in the very same way, getting it here in the same way, burning it in the same way, but trying to cut down on those emissions.
Well, and we do have scrubbers that have reduced our pollutants, and they have been put on top of the smokestacks at IU, and that's done an incredible job. You know, there are different like levels of the scrubbers, and they capture more of the pollutants than other kinds, but they, you know, the scrubbers that we have now, they do reduce the mercury that goes into the air, but they don't reduce the amount of carbon that goes into the air. And that's, you know, we're talking about climate change. CO2 emissions are the leading contributor, and they are, the leading cause of them is from coal plants. So that's a problem. But clean coal technology is also dubbed on things like washing coal, which, you know, is simply washing coal where it's mined, and then that wastewater has to go somewhere, and in places like Appalachia, it goes right back into the bottom of the streams where people are getting their well water from, and that means that all those chemicals stay right there, and then people, you know, are exposed to that. You know, they can't shower without worrying about getting cancer, and that's a problem. So, yeah.
So, as coal-free IU, when you do you actually give a directive when you you give the petitions that thousands of people on campus are interested in moving away from coal, but have you as an organization decided to ask that right now we should really work on conserving those leaking pipes, we should make sure that they're not leaking as much, or do you say we really think it's best to go to solar panels or blank? Do you have an actual directive that you are an option that you're giving the administration as you're asking them to take something away?
You know, we really want IU to make the best financial, environmental, and social decisions that they think are best. And we do have, you know, a lot of trust and faith in our administrators because that's their job. And, you know, they do their job every day and we trust them. So the best that we can do is point them in directions that we believe in. And, you know, those are kind of tricky. We're talking about total energy use. But IU is completing a energy master plan, which they hired an engineering firm to complete. And that was scanning all the buildings to see how much electricity and heating and cooling they were using, and to look at what are the options for our campus. And IU plans to install like smart grid monitors essentially in some of the buildings so they would know exactly how much energy is being used. That's pretty innovative, and we think that that will help IU and us make a better decision about what is best for our future. And so that should be released soon.
Like this spring, do you know?
Hopefully, yes. It was already due to be released.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Have they consulted you, or did you get a chance to meet with any of those assessors?
Yeah, so we met with the engineering firm one time last year when they were doing their scanning, and that was great. I actually was in D.C. at an internship, but and I think Chris,
I was not there either. This was some other people.
Right. So, you know, I think what they did was they talked about, you know, what directions would coal-free IU like to see IU go in, and obviously, you know, we're saying, you know, as a long-term goal, we would like you to switch to renewable energy, and we want you to set benchmarks to get there, and that, you know, that's efficiency projects and, you know, other things like that, switching buildings that we can switch off of coal. So
I'm curious too if some of these alternative forms, renewable energy, wind, sun, biomass, are we ever going to come to a point where we're seeing negative ramifications from those sources? Is there drawbacks to those?
There are some drawbacks. The biggest one with wind power is that it gets in the way of some migratory birds. But that damage can be minimized by using specialized turbine mm-hmm. designs. Mm-hmm. So if we can get into that, then that really will not be a problem. Mm-hmm. The rest of them have almost no discernible problems at all, so that should not be a problem at mm-hmm. all.
And, you know, obviously, like, where you buy, it's important to pay attention, especially if you're buying solar panels, where you buy your solar panels and, you know, what do those factories do with the chemicals that they use in that process and that kind of thing. And we hope that that's part of the equation when they're factoring in what we do with our future. But like we said, you know, solar panels aren't going to be used for heating and cooling, so
not there. And then if we were to shift away right now, like you said, it's required that IU relies on Indiana resources, including manpower, though you mentioned that the miners, those roles are becoming more mechanical. But what happens to those Indiana mining communities mm-hmm. as we move away from coal?
Yeah, so IU has to purchase any public institution in Indiana has to purchase Indiana coal. So just to clarify that point. And then, but, you know, Indiana's seen actually a huge kind of growth in mining with the opening of Bear Run. And we export a lot of our coal, majority of our coal. And we actually export a lot of our power, too. So I don't really think it is actually going to affect probably the miners, you know, as far as jobs go, because we're exporting more coal. So that's a growing area. And our campus is a tiny part of that equation.
The other thing is that Indiana is actually the leading state in wind energy growth right now. So we're creating a lot of jobs for wind industry. So as we see fewer jobs in the coal industry, we're also seeing increased jobs in the wind industry. So we have not much of a net difference in jobs.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Weisler and Megan Anderson from Coal Free IU. I just want to close on, you had a great Valentine petition push today, brought it to President McRobbie. What is coming up? Anything else this semester? And what's your plan in the years out?
Mm-hmm. So this semester, we're obviously waiting on a response. So that'll, probably have some bearing on what we work on. We're excited to see the Energy Master Plan come out and have a chance to look at that document and, kind of look at some possible funding sources for IU and how we can help IU transition off coal. So a lot of what we'll do will probably be research when that comes out. And then we're planning to take a trip to West Virginia over spring break to see how communities are working to combat mountaintop removal. And so that's one thing that we have coming up. And another thing is we're going to show The Last Mountain sometime during the semester, so hopefully we can do that at the Buskirk Chumley, and that's a really great film, and we hope that a lot of people from the community and campus will come to that. So,
more long-range plans depend on what happens with the Energy Master Plan. We'll have to see where the university intends to go with our energy plans.
And then if anyone wants to get involved in your organization, you have weekly meetings or a website?
We have weekly meetings, and they should email coalfreeiu@gmail.com. Our meetings are 7:15 every Wednesday in Valentine 016. You can find us on Facebook, Coal Free IU. So,
well, I really want to thank again Chris Weisler and Megan Anderson, both students at IU, both involved with the Coal Free IU project, the research coordinator and president, respectively. And that's it for Interchange tonight. My name's Allison Bechtesh. I'm the host. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by Lewis Malone. Our original theme music was made by Jamil Effiam, and stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman, coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.